Pfizer moves to get its COVID-19 vaccine approved for children as young as 6 months. Plus, Google parent Alphabet announces a 20-to-1 stock split. What does that mean for investors? And the Islamic State rears its head in a daring prison break in Syria.
The Syrian government has not only zero ability, but also zero interest in cracking down on ISIS.
It's Wednesday, February 2nd. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Russian President Vladimir Putin has said the West ignored his demands over the Ukraine standoff. At a Kremlin press conference, Putin stated that he did not believe the U.S. response was adequate in addressing Russia's concerns about NATO expansion in Eastern Europe. At the time, the letters between the U.S. and Russia had not been made public, but our Moscow reporter Matthew Luxmore has some insights this morning.
Spain's El País newspaper published what it says is the full text of the responses. Documents that pledge, among others, to continue discussions over Russia's concerns, while also floating the possibility of increased communication about military exercises and a potential withdrawal of NATO missiles from Eastern Europe.
Putin has expressed a willingness to continue talks, but Ukraine has said that little constructive discussion can take place until Russia removes troops from the Ukrainian border. Drug company Pfizer and its partner BioNTech have asked the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to approve its COVID-19 vaccine for use in children under 5 years of age. Pfizer initially found a two-dose vaccine didn't produce the desired immune response in children aged 2 to 4, but Pfizer has argued that kids may need a third shot in order to achieve full protection. Sources say the company filed for approval at the FDA's encouragement since it would help clear the way for kids to eventually receive that booster down the line. Native American tribes have reached a nearly $600 million settlement with Johnson & Johnson and three U.S. drug distributors to resolve litigation stemming from the ongoing opioid crisis. More than 400 tribes had sued J&J, along with AmerisourceBergen, McKesson, and Cardinal Health. Lawyers for the tribes have said that Native Americans have suffered some of the highest rates of drug overdose deaths during the opioid crisis, and that tribal governments have had to pay higher costs for health care and social services as a result. Johnson & Johnson said the settlement wasn't an admission of wrongdoing and that the company would continue to defend itself against litigation. And General Motors says it's accelerating plans to launch new electric vehicles and plans to establish a third factory to build plug-in trucks. That news comes as the automaker announced stronger than expected earnings in spite of chip shortages and a lack of new inventory at dealers. CEO Mary Barra says GM now hopes to sell 400,000 electric vehicles in North America this year and next, a sharp acceleration from last year when it sold fewer than 25,000 EVs. Google parent Alphabet has posted a major jump in fourth quarter revenue as it continues to benefit from a surge in digital advertising. The company also announced a 20-for-1 stock split that will go into effect this summer. Here with more on the thinking behind that split and what it means for investors is Journal editor Jim Wilhite. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Luke.
Could you break down this stock split and how it's going to work exactly?
Okay, well, on July 1st, everyone who owns a share of Alphabet will be given another 19 shares to match it. All the shares will be worth 1/20th of their value before the split. So the split itself doesn't actually have any effect on the value of what they're holding. It's the same amount, just chopped up into smaller bits.
What does this mean for the company and not least potential new investors?
Well, by lowering the price of each individual share, it can make it more accessible to some investors who have less money to spend. A lower share price could also simply be more enticing, could feel like a less risky bet. There has been some research showing that stocks tend to rise a little bit, 5% in the year following a split, with about half of that gain coming right after the announcement.
Got it. And I could see why there is some sticker shock on Alphabet shares currently trading above $2,700 a share. But I have to ask, why is lowering a share price even relevant in an age when many brokerages have eliminated commissions and allow for trading of fractional shares?
It is true that some brokerages offer fractions of shares to retail traders with very low points of entry. So again, a lot of the difference here could be psychological. It's like a vote of confidence in the stock coming from the company itself.
Got it. And you can also get voting rights. Is that correct? With full shares as opposed to fractional shares?
It depends on the share structure of the individual company. Some will have different classes of shares with different voting rights, so it just will depend from case to case.
That was Journal editor Jim Wilhite. Jim, thank you so much.
Thanks, Luke.
Coming up, the Islamic State is once again in the headlines after staging a daring prison break in Syria. But is it time to put the terror group back on our radar? We'll get the answer to that and more from our Middle East reporter after the break.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
After 3 years of relative calm, Islamic State has made it back to the international front pages. Last week, some 200 militants attacked a prison holding thousands of Islamic State members in Syria. The prison break sparked gun battles with American and Syrian troops, forcing about 45,000 people to flee their homes, and it revealed what many security experts have been warning about, that Islamic State has been slowly preparing for a comeback in Syria and Iraq. Our Middle East reporter Benoit Faucon has been following the story, and he joins us now. Hi, Benoit. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Benoit, what should we make of the Islamic State prison break? Does this mean the group is back in some way?
I would say more the group never left. And there are two reasons for that. The first reason is actually as a jail itself exemplify and other prison camps, there are thousands and thousands of members, both male, female, and children, who effectively never left the countries and were in jail. So that was one factor. Plus, a number of members, fighters retreated, you know, in eastern Syria and western Iraq and just hid among the population where they came from, because a lot of them were especially local Arab tribesmen who had really been sort of functioning in an autonomous way for a long time.
Were there any details about this attack that really jumped out to you and then maybe speak to what Islamic State is today?
Well, when you go on pro-ISIS Telegram channels, they're very often dominated by women because they are the one that have more access, you know, even in the camps, you know, to mobile phones. So a lot of the social media activity, the escape channels, et cetera, is handled by women. And so you have some messages saying, where are the men? You know, we're the one fighting, you know, at least online and through our escape routes, and you seem to be completely idle in your jail. So at least the visibility was taken over, and also partly the numbers were more female dominated in ISIS, which you wouldn't necessarily expect. And typically in Idlib, the organization was mostly female escapees and very active, you know, ordering assassinations, raising funds.
And what does this prison break tell us about the Islamic State's current capabilities?
On one hand, because obviously there was long-term planning in preparing this, as part of actually the Islamic State stated policy dating back from the last months of life of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, you know, before he was killed, which was a strategy called Breaking the Fortress, which was specifically focused on freeing prisoners and basically replenish their kind of the manpower in all over the world. So they had done that in Afghanistan, they did that in Congo, and now this was obviously the jewel in the crown, because the biggest number of members jailed anywhere in the world are in Syria, in eastern Syria especially. So yeah, it reflects long-term planning.
Benoit, what has the response been in Western capitals, and in particular in Washington, to this prison break? Is the Islamic State starting to return to the priority list?
Well, we do know, so not necessarily because of this prison break, because again, that largely failed. But I would say globally, there is our awareness that Islamic State is able to rebuild its capability in other places. When I say rebuild, even, you know, rise, actually, there are places like Congo, Mozambique, where there is a real growth of Islamic State in alliance with local groups. And I know that's actually a major worry in Washington in terms of whether they're not attacking outside their territories or their region of operation, but they are international connections and they could be leveraged going forward. I do know there are investigations and really a lot of scrutiny on that aspect, and especially in Africa, actually more in some way more than in Syria.
At the risk of oversimplifying this situation, Benoit, is Islamic State's resurgence in any way occurring because the U.S. has shifted its focus away from the region?
Well, it's likely a factor, but at the same time, that particular takeover had been long in the making. So yes, obviously, the U.S. was less focused, but they did maintain a force there. And also, the location was not a core U.S. sort of, it was not an area where the U.S. was the most present. I mean, they are more focused on protecting oil fields, typically. The U.S. intervention did basically make that operation, on the whole, pretty much a failure, because there has been escapes. I hear there were typically even some explosive experts that left, but a lot of them apparently are hiding very close by. They haven't been able to move very far. And the numbers are nowhere near the one that ISIS mentioned of 800.
So with that in mind, I wonder, what are the capabilities of local authorities such as the Iraqi government or the Kurds to keep Islamic State in check?
But that's the thing. It's happening far from the central government's sort of main areas of control. So that was already a limit. The second limit is, once there was a caliphate, meaning a kind of a specific territorial control with the fighters moving in the open, I mean, now it's always the opposite. They're invisible. So in a way, the government has actually less traction on both sides. And you add that the fact that it's eastern Syria, which is controlled by Kurdish forces with U.S. assistance. On that point, the Syrian government has not only zero ability, but also zero interest in cracking down on ISIS. The only place where they would, and they are, fighting ISIS is in the desert more to the south. But again, these areas are very difficult to control, especially when you don't have a formal territory under ISIS control.
Right, and I guess this all makes it even harder for the U.S. to leave this region, and thus potentially further entrenching the U.S. in certain parts of the Middle East.
That's absolutely, yeah. But at this stage, though, the capability that is present is not very pricey compared with a conventional warfare. So I don't think that's going to be too much of an issue. And I've heard actually there's a lot of in and outs also in East Africa for the same reasons. But again, we're talking about extremely low manpower, so I don't think it's going to be controversial to maintain the effort.
Benoit, thank you very much for the time. It was a pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you.
And finally, Starbucks has hinted that it's planning further price increases this year, after first raising the cost of a cup of coffee in October and then again last month. While increased labor costs are a big reason your morning cup is costing more, WSJ Markets reporter Hartika Singh says rising coffee prices are worth keeping an eye on too.
So there's only two main kinds of coffee. There's Arabica and Robusta. Arabica is the one you want to drink. You know, that's the one that Starbucks mostly sells. And Arabica, most of it comes from Brazil. There was a very persistent drought in Brazil. And then there was a frost, which has roiled the top coffee growing region in the pandemic. And that has pushed up coffee prices by a lot. I think at one point last year, they were like at twice their levels at the end of 2020. And when the good kind of coffee is getting hurt by weather events, you're definitely going to see an impact on your breakfast table.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but I'm nostalgic thinking of dollar coffee now on the streets of Manhattan, Arabica beans or not. And that's what's news for Wednesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.